Sean Bussey, alcoholic.
Hey, Sean.
And Muscle Rite is February 15th of 2009. And very honored to be here. So this is my second time in the car group. And there's a phrase that my sponsor used for a minute. I don't know that he says it much anymore. But there was a time in our fellowship. And quite honestly, if you walk into some groups, you may experience this. But apathy and indifference with the recovery program of Alcoholics Anonymous and just the fellowship. And you walk in and it's kind of sad. And he would say, meet that apathy and indifference with enthusiasm and energy. And every time I step into not only this group, but I know many of you outside of this room, and when I'm around you, I see energy and enthusiasm for Alcoholics Anonymous, because this is a lot that I know we needed this program long before we ever got here. And there's a deep sense of gratitude in this meeting. So very honored that I get to stand behind this podium and share my experience, strength, and hope. And I'm going to try to do that in a general way. I will, to the best of my ability, try to describe to you what it was like before I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, before I got sober, what happened, and how I was introduced to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, and what my life is like today. And I will also be honest with you that in my personal story, you're going to hear a lot about God. And I was introduced to God at a young age and had some theories about that God that proved to be wrong as I came into Alcoholics Anonymous. But this thing is about God and the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And what I mean by program, just to get it out of the way in the front part, is the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. This group is not the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. The program of Alcoholics Anonymous, as outlined in our first 164 pages of our book, AA, Alcoholics Anonymous, it is the 12 steps worked and practiced as a way of life. And so when I say program, that's what I mean. And I know many of you in the room know that, but those are the things I mean. But that program and this literature was written to introduce me to a God of my understanding. And it did just that. And I got way more than I ever thought I would get. I got a second shot at life, and I'm super grateful. And so anytime I get the chance to come share my experience, as much as I don't necessarily like to be talking, I'm grateful. And so with that, I will try to share this in a general way. So I grew up in an alcoholic home. My first memory of my home was my parents getting a divorce. I didn't really know anything different other than the fact that my dad drank a lot. And when he drank a lot, my parents fought. And my dad was he liked other women besides my mother, is the way I'll put it. And he was just not a great person, at least my experience with him. And so when I was like 7 or 8 years old, my parents got a divorce. And that's the first memory I have, really. I can't kind of recall much before that. And so my family split. My mom moved to a little town called Justin. My dad continued living in a little town called Rome, Texas, not too far from here. And so I moved in with my dad. And I'm 7, 8 years old. My mom and my sisters, I have two older sisters, they moved to Justin. Family split. And my watch, I don't want to spend a whole lot of time talking about my dad, but it is important because I watched active alcoholism and I watched my father die of alcoholism. And for many people who are not alcoholic, that's probably a pretty good warning sign that I should never drink. And for me, like, I thought, well, I'm never going to be like him. And then by the time I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I had done all that my father had done and more, as I'm dragging not only myself in here, but a lot of people, a lot of wreckage behind me. But I didn't intend for that because I watched active alcoholism kill a man. And this thing is deadly, whether you think it is or not, or you realize it is or not. If it's your first time here and you're thinking, man, if you're considering going back out, I would just like to caution you against that, because there's no guarantee we get back in. And I want to say from the onset that those of us that are in the room that have stayed and remained willing and open-minded and honest, it's not because there's anything special about us. I don't understand it because there's not anything special about us. But there's a whole lot of people that never get that. And I have come to believe that it's just the grace of a loving God that for some reason he allows us to be willing, honest, and open-minded enough to get this deal. And there's a lot of people that don't. And so very, very grateful. But I watched my dad just basically die of alcoholism. The way I'll put it is I'll describe his home. And that sounds weird, but my father lived, he was a president and CEO of a marble company, very successful, drank it all away. And he was living in this, when we first, my parents first divorced, we lived in this double wide trailer. And in about 2 years, it got repossessed by his own sister who owned the company, which tells you how that relationship was going. And so then he gets his life a little bit back together because that's kind of how he did it. And then he got a single wide trailer. And we live in a trailer park, got a single wide trailer. And then a couple of years later, that also got repossessed by his sister. And then and so she decided, hey, I'm not really going to give you any more mobile homes. And that didn't really work out. So my dad decided that he was going to get what he called a shotgun house. And what it was is me and him lived inside of it was a storage building. And a shotgun house is supposed to be where you open that front door and you can see through the back door. Well, this thing didn't have a back door. It was literally like an 8 by 10. You think I'm joking, man. It was an 8 by 10 storage building. And my dad, being the grandiose alcoholic that he was, we didn't have any furniture in there. He had a giant king size waterbed. It's just like screams ego and self-centeredness of like, I don't need a place to walk or like a hallway or furniture. I just need a king size waterbed. I'm living in a storage building. And I lived up on top of there was a renovated bathroom, and I lived up on top of this little, like, I had like a futon mattress that slid in there, and I had a little 13-inch black and white TV and a Nintendo 64. And quite honestly, I thought that was awesome. I didn't know anything different. And then some years later, when I was, I'll just kind of fast forward to that. I'm going to bounce around a little bit in the early stages. But when I was 13, about to be 14 years old, my father had seemingly got his life together, but he was still drinking and doing a lot of drugs. His heart just exploded one day. Took a breath after telling a joke and just fell over dead. And I remember getting that phone call from my stepmother. And by that time, I had been introduced to the idea of God. Came to believe in a God, did not have faith in God or anything like that. But I just remember thinking, this was my concept of God, that he was real, but he was very distant. And he really didn't care much intimately about my welfare or what was happening in my life or anything like that. And so he was just kind of this distant thing out there. Not a father, maybe a creator that kind of set the thing in motion and then just kind of like was like, hey, they'll figure it out. And this, that was my concept of God. And that same year, or actually it was 1 year prior to that, I was introduced to this God. And I had gone to a church camp and was introduced to this God, in my understanding. And I don't know about for you guys, but I needed a lot of structure in my life before I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. And AA was helpful because it gave me some structure. Well, the church kind of worked the same way for me. I was restless, irritable, and discontent long before I ever took a drink. And so when you define those words, I don't have time to get into them and I don't have them memorized. But when you get into those words, I'm like, man, they describe me to the T. Extremely sensitive. You know, I'm going to do whatever I can to get what I want. Like, there's nothing going to step in my way. And I remember the sense of ease and comfort that I got when I took a drink for the first time. But this structure that I found in religion was really helpful for me because it gave me like a set of rules and some accountability. And I liked that. I didn't know that I needed that, but I just liked it. And so I fell in love with that. And so from the time I'm 12, 13 years old, I was just inside in the church. My parents didn't go to church, but I was there and I was reading and I was studying and I was doing all the things that you're supposed to do there. And I was even the kid that was, I would describe myself as self-righteous at the time. I thought I was helping people, but I would carry my Bible around in my back pocket. And if I saw you sinning, I thought I needed to confront you and tell you you were sinning. And in the church, in the environment I grew up in, that was called witnessing. And so I thought, man, I'm doing them a favor. Man, I can remember like my friends just looking at me like, who do you think you are, dude? And man, it all changed in high school for me, you know, because so I was in a place where people took seriously like discipleship. That's what you would call that in church. It's like sponsorship here. And I had a man that just really invested in me and tried to like set me on the right track. But again, it was belief. It was not faith. And so I'm doing it for all the wrong reasons. I'm doing it to try to earn a relationship with God because God is this like deity out there. And then if I follow the rules, then he'll love me. It's not the other way around, that he loves me so that I want to do what he says to do. I didn't understand it that way. It was more like, if I keep this thing and I'm lucky at the end of my life, like, he'll love me and he'll receive me. Like, that's just how I viewed it. But there was a guy that really tried hard to invest in me. And so he gave me some morals and values and things to live by. And I remember being introduced to ladies for the first time when I was like 15 or 16. And I thought, well, I know some of the things he tells me not to do, but I really like ladies. And I think I want to compromise some of those things that he's telling me not to do. And so I started with that. And then for me, it slowly just began to unravel. And so, and then other things that I thought, well, I enjoyed that. And so I'm just going to do more of that. And then I enjoyed that. And I'm just going to do more of that. And so anything that was all of those morals that that man was trying to teach me, I just began to throw all those out the window for the fact that it brought me satisfaction and joy, because the root of my problem is not drinking. It is selfishness and self-centeredness. That is the root of my problem. And so if something brings me joy, then I'm going to do that. And so I started to compromise these things. By the time I graduate high school, I realized really quickly that I can't keep all the rules that this God has described. And so I still believe that he exists and he's there if I want to go back to that. But I thought, you know what, the heck with that. I can't keep the rules. So I'm just going to do what I want to do. And so I started drinking. And I remember being, this was not my first drink, but it started my drinking career, if you will. I had like little sips here and there. I had gotten drunk once before. And my experience with that was that I picked up a drink of alcohol. I started drinking and I didn't stop until I was blacked out and passed out. And that was just the first time. And that's how I drank. I don't have a lot of funny drinking stories because I don't remember a lot of the way I drank. I was a very early blackout drinker. And I was the kind of drinker that I would black out about 4 to 6 drinks in. And then I would just go for days. And I looked normal to you, but I really didn't know what was going on or where I was at or who I was with or anything like that. And I would just come to in places, and not always the places where I started or anything like that, but I'm just come to. And then I would have like little blips, you know, here and there where you're like, it's like a movie where it goes dark for a minute. And then all of a sudden it's like, boom, I'm here. And then it goes dark again. And it's boom, I'm here. And then it goes dark again. And it just, that was my experience. So I'm 17 years old. I'm on a cruise ship for our senior trip, man, just a terrible cocktail for a kid that's like been in churches, you know, for most of his middle school and high school career. He's on a cruise ship, unsupervised. And the places that I was going, I could drink at the age I was. And so, man, I just drank as hard as I could. And I stayed blacked out drunk the whole time I was on there. And I thought, that was amazing. Like, this is the thing I've been missing. And I love the doctor's opinion for me was a saving grace, because it described something that was wrong with me that I didn't know was wrong with me. I thought everybody drank that way. It was news to me that only alcoholics drink that way. And I couldn't figure out why when I started drinking, I couldn't turn it off. And for me, I like the effect produced by alcohol. I like the fact that it gives me that sense of ease and comfort. I like the fact that I can't differentiate the truth from the false. I like the fact that I can make tomorrow seem exactly like I needed to, and I can forget about what I did yesterday. I like that. And for me, alcohol is absolutely a spiritual experience. And it wasn't until I came to Alcoholics Anonymous and I worked the program that I found the same sense of ease and comfort that I find today by working a few simple steps. But at the time, I didn't know that. And so when you're wound up tight, you're restless, you're irritable, you're discontent, you're resentful at your whole life because you feel like God has punished you, you're fearful perpetually all the time, you're dishonest because you can't tell the truth, because if people find out, then the whole thing's a wash and you're going to be found out, and then they're going to know how bad you really are. And so when you're like that and you drink, it makes everything else, just all the tension just go away. It's like, man, for a few hours, I can be okay. And so that's what happened to me. And I just chased that as often as I could from the time I was 17 years old until I got interrupted and realized that I may have a problem drinking when I was 20. And honestly, if it hadn't been for me being a terrible drunk driver and getting pulled over and things like that, I don't know that I would be standing here today. Had our justice system not intervened in my life. Because I really didn't know anything was wrong with what I was doing. And I had a lot of fun. And it wasn't until, and I'm not saying you have to have consequences to get, earn your seat here. That's not required. But for me, it earned me a seat a lot sooner than I probably would have made it here. And I'm very grateful for that. So I'm 20 years old. I get popped with my first DWI. And at this point, I'm drinking all the time. And I need to introduce you to my wife because she's a big part of my story. Her name's Nicole. Nicole and I met the summer after my senior year, and we met at a party, and I knew something was different about her. And I really did think, man, this could be like a lady I could marry. And that's not how I viewed women to that point. Is not, first of all, I didn't view them as ladies. And I never thought about marriage because I was so terrified of commitment. But this woman was different. And I knew that. And that would become really important for me because she would be, as I look back and when I get sober, she would be the thing that would allow me to realize that alcohol was really my master at some point. And I'll tell that story in a minute. But here we started in 17. We started living together and had lived together for a couple of years. And I'm the type of drinker that, you know, I start drinking at home. I leave and I tell you, I'll be back by a certain time, and I don't show up until the next morning. And for the way that I drank, I would black out and I would do things with other people that I was not committed to. And I was in a committed relationship with this woman, and I didn't honor any of that. And so I would come stumbling in, and she's getting ready for work at 6 a.m., 7 a.m. And I come stumbling in and I lean against the door and I just look at her. And at first it's kind of anger. And then that slowly starts to change into where she's just broken. And her spirit is just completely shattered because now she can't trust me. She's deeply in love with me, but she can't trust me. She doesn't know where I'm at. She doesn't know what I'm doing. And alcoholism has just completely destroyed her. And she doesn't have a problem with alcohol. And so when I'm 20, I get my first DWI. And so she gets the first call from jail. And she, you know, she gets me out. To me, that was normal. Like a lot of people I hung out with had DWIs, so it didn't faze me at all. I turned 21, my first month of probation. And so what do? I go out and get a public intoxication because I start drinking on Fry Street and I can't stop. And so before I even meet my probation officer, and this is, guys, like, this is not what normal people do. Normal people, quite honestly, I remember my lawyer saying, hey, Sean, just don't drink for 15 months. And she's not. My mom's sitting right next to me. If there was a Bible in front of me, I would have put my hand on it and sworn to you, yes, sir, I will do that. And I meant it with every fiber of my being. Absolutely. And a week later, I'm drunk and blacked out, and I can't figure out how I got there yet. And so for me, I lose all control. I have no control over the amount I take in. I have no control when I'm going to do it. This thing's got me. And so I'm 20, 21, you got public intoxication. Before I even meet my probation officer, my first phone call to her was, hey, I went to jail last night. What am I supposed to do next? And she said, well, you're going to come see me, and then you're going to go see a counselor, and we're going to go from there. So she introduced me to a counselor. The counselor said, you might be alcoholic. She said, you could be. The conversation with her was, you're either full-blown alcoholic or you're a potential alcoholic. Those don't sound great. Like, neither one of those sound awesome. And so then she said, I'm going to recommend that you go to intensive outpatient program. And again, self-knowledge will avail me nothing. And I would go there to that intensive outpatient program. It was just a few blocks from places I like to drink. And I would go in there and I would talk about alcoholism. And I would hear about alcoholism and I would agree with them that I was an alcoholic. And then I'd walk right out of that place and I'd walk to that bar and I would start drinking and I wouldn't be able to stop till the night, the deal was morning. And I would do that on repeat. And then finally, I thought self-knowledge did work because I thought I learned enough about alcoholism that I thought, well, maybe I am alcoholic. And so now it's just about knowing that I'm alcoholic, and now I'll know how to drink right. Or I'll either figure out how to like moderate, or maybe I'll just stay with it altogether. So I started using the word I'm an alcoholic and things like that. And the great thing about that program was that I was introduced to the AA program through there. We read through the book and there was a men that came in and carried the message. And I remember David and Bruce and those guys brought the message in there. And I remember thinking distinctly, like I'm 21 years old and I'm thinking, you know, if alcohol is ever really a problem, I mean, I'll probably try that place. I mean, and it never occurred to me that most 21-year-olds were not sitting inside of an intensive outpatient program on probation for 15 months for a DWI. Like, that's not most 21-year-olds' experience. That did never occurred to me. And the fact that nobody in my family wants to have a relationship with me anymore, I've destroyed this woman's life, Nicole, and none of that occurred to me. It was just, yeah, if it ever gets bad enough, I'll maybe try something. And finally, I did try, and I stayed sober for about 60 days. And we moved, we did a geographical change. And at that point we had gotten engaged. This was in 2008, early 2008. We got engaged in 2007. And so early 2008, January, I think, is when we moved to a little town called Sunset, Texas. It's north of Decatur, if you're familiar with that. Out in the middle of nowhere. Our parents lived on like 60 acres in the middle of the woods. And we thought, man, Sean will be safe here. Like, there's no bars. There's no, you know, he's safe. And I love Fred's story in our book because it describes, you know, it's the end of another perfect day, not a cloud on the horizon. And I remember driving my 1989 Caprice Classic because that's what I was driving at the time. And if you know what that is, it's not a great car. But the same way that my dad just began to reduce homes, I reduced cars. They got bigger, but they got a lot uglier. And so I ended up with this 1989 Caprice Classic, which honestly, looking back on it, made a great back road car because it has a huge back seat. You can drop an Igloo cooler back there, fill it up, and it's just like reach your hand back, grab. So I'm driving home in that thing. It's the end of another perfect day, not a cloud on the horizon. And I think, man, I had drank in 90 days. Like, that's a big accomplishment for me. And I drive past this beer store that I've driven by hundreds of times. And the thought crosses my mind, like, what if I just drink a beer tonight? Like, that would be fine. I could probably handle that. Before I ever even pick up a drink or even have a drink, I walk into that beer store and I'm looking and I think, well, maybe I'll get a 40 instead of just a can. I'll get a 40. You know what? I'll get two 40s and I'll probably be thirsty tomorrow. So I'll drink two 40s tonight and then I'll get a 12 pack for tomorrow and I'll be good. And so it went from one beer to me back roading for several hours that night, all before I ever took a drink. And so I hope that in a general way, I'm able to describe what our literature describes as I have a physical allergy to alcohol that once I start drinking, I cannot stop. That is fundamentally different than the average summer drinker. That never has happened to my mom. That's never happened to my wife. But all of you in the room who have alcoholism understand exactly what that means. And you understand that frothy emotional feels seldom suffices. It didn't matter how many times I broke that woman's heart. It didn't matter how many times they said, hey, Sean, you should do this. You should do that. You're a better person than this. It didn't matter how much. That was all fraught the emotional appeal. The only thing that was going to grab my attention was something with depth and weight and a rock bottom. And so hopefully that story that I just shared with you is a description of the mental obsession. It never even crossed my mind that at that point I've graduated from my LP program. And all of my past history and the fact that I'm trying to hide in the middle of the woods away from alcohol, like that's my lot in life now. And it never occurred to me that all of that had to do with my selfishness and selfishness and alcoholism. Never occurred to me. And so I just thought, well, I'll just drink because that's what I do. And so I started back roading every night after that. And then about a month after that, I got tired of living out in those woods and I wanted to be back with my friends and I wanted to drink like I wanted to drink. And remember, I told you I was engaged to this woman. I love her unconditionally. When we moved back to Denton, I can remember I started becoming unfaithful again. And I got caught in rapid succession. Again, I black out and I go home with people that I don't know. And then I come to in my bed next to a woman who loves me deeply. And I love her. And at this point is when I know that alcohol is my master. And at this point is that I know that I am beyond human aid when I look back on it. I didn't know that at the time, wasn't thinking about any of that. But when I look back on this, this was the moment where alcohol was absolutely my master. It was more important to me than anything else. And she caught me and me coming out of a drunken stupor, she said, hey, are we done? And I said, yeah. And I remember not feeling an ounce of sadness when she left. I remember thinking, thank God that woman is out of my life and I can drink how I want to drink and I can do what I want to do and there ain't nobody going to stop me. And so that's what I did. And I drank and I was in a blackout from March of 2008 until August of 2009 when I almost T-boned a police officer on my 15th month of probation. And so I'm almost out, never had it. And we started not great, me and my probation officer. We didn't end great either. Never had to see her again if I didn't want to. And I just almost T-boned that police officer and he pulls me over and takes me to jail for my second DWI. And God doing for me what I couldn't do for myself, that man was the best friend of my brother-in-law who was a police officer at University of North Texas, which is where I got pulled over. And if I would have just name dropped, I would have gotten bailed out. But I had a name drop. The first time I had never name dropped, because I had been caught with the UNT police officer before, and I was sure to name drop my brother. But this time I didn't. I just held my hands in my head, and I thought, all right, I'm done. Like, I don't know what to do. And that was the beginning of the end for me. I wish I could tell you that I stayed sober after that, but that's not the truth. Fear sobered me up for a while. I love when Bill says that. That was my experience. I was terrified of putting alcohol in my body because I knew I couldn't control what was going to happen after that. Pretty soon, my buddy comes in. It's midterms in 2009, and I've now been revoked from probation. I'm facing a trial in about a year, and my buddy comes in and he says, hey, it's midterms. Let's celebrate. And I thought, okay. So we just leave and we go do that. And that starts me on this journey again, back into drinking every single day and blacking out. And February of 2009, there was a series of things that happened that Nicole was back in my life again after a long period of separation. And I had convinced her that I wanted to start over, try again, and all those things. I was a master manipulator. And I remember coming to on that Monday morning after I'd had that conversation with her on Sunday night, and it was a 3-day bender for me. And I came to on my bed, and I remembered that conversation, and I thought, I don't want to be locked down like that again. I'm going to have to call her. I'm going to have to tell her that I didn't mean anything that I said. And I called her and I told her that. And again, this is the woman that I'm now married to. And at the time I really did love her deeply. And I thought, I can't meet you for dinner. And I'm not going to be committed to you. And she said, lose my number. Don't ever call me again. And I remember thinking, yeah, I deserve that. And I remember thinking at that point, this was what began to get me into Alcoholics Anonymous. But I thought, I don't really know how to stop drinking. Like, I don't know how to stop behaving that way. I don't know how to stop hurting the people that are closest to me. I don't know how to stop consuming alcohol and destroying everything that's promising in my life. And so I decided to take my lawyer's advice and go to AA. And so for any of you that get your paper signed and you're here, that was my story. I didn't want what AA had to offer. I told you about my experience with the church, and it was deeply offensive to me that you would say God as we understood it. And I'm just gonna be honest with you about that. I didn't like that. In the faith I grew up in, that was a heresy. And I was, couldn't draw a sober breath, but I would sure try to defend my faith. Oh my gosh, so dumb. So dumb. And I did a lot of harmful things to Alcoholics Anonymous, and you were so kind to me to tell me to keep coming back, and you let me say stupid things, and you let me do stupid things, and you just let me keep coming back, and I'm so grateful for that. And but I had a hard time coming into AA, and I had a hard time working the steps because of that. And some of you in the room may empathize, that may be your experience. And if you want to talk to me about how that changed, I would be glad to have that conversation, because I know there's a lot of people that struggle with that. But I got desperate enough and willing enough to try something different. So February 10th, I believe it was, I went to a newcomer meeting, and I was in this desperate, hopeless state. And after the meeting, I asked the guy, I said, hey, I don't remember what the meeting was about. I know it was a newcomer meeting. But I went up to the guy afterwards and said, hey, what do I need to do to stay sober? And he just sat with me. And he was the first guy that I could remember that not one time did he talk about my drinking. Not one time did he even ask me about my drinking. He just sat with me and he said, hey, Sean, let me tell you what I did. I got a sponsor. And I started working the steps with that sponsor. And I would recommend that you get a sponsor too. If you be alcoholic, here's how I drink. This guy's 55 years old, stockbroker, tries to ride a Harley on weekends. Like, and I'm 23 years old and I'm a punk. And we had nothing in common except for the fact that we drank the same way. And I'm glad that man did what he did, because he described to me in a general way the way that he drank. And I started to identify and I started to think, okay, like, I've been in my head, I'm thinking, do the rest of these people drink this way too? Like, if they do, then I might be in the right spot. And I had been coming to AA for off and on for a while, but I never heard it the way that I heard that day. Again, God's grace and mercy. I don't deserve any of that. And for whatever reason, on that particular day, my ears were open and my eyes were open, and I was actually open-minded to the message of Alcoholics Anonymous. And so he gives me a few names and numbers and actions to take, and I don't do any of that stuff. I leave. And again, I'd love to tell you, like, oh, I got sober after that. That did not happen. February 14th, I'm planning this great Valentine's Day dinner for the girl that I was dating. And when you're an alcoholic of my type, you got to get ramped up for stuff like that. So I line up 4 shots of tequila by that point. Shot tequila is my drink of choice. So I'm lining up 4 shots of tequila. I'm pounding those things. And now I'm feeling good again. And now I start busting into the champagne that her and I were going to enjoy together because she's a little bit late. And I'm getting antsy because I've started something that I can't stop. So now I pick up that and I finish that bottle off. By the time she gets there, she gets one bottle, I finish it. And then she goes to bed like a responsible human being because we had to work the next day. And I'm thinking, I can't stop. Like, yeah, you go to bed, but I'm going to keep drinking. And the only thing we had and I was living in a bachelor pad at the time. And the only thing we had in the refrigerator was Frenzy of box wine. And God, if I had a different drink for my last one, it would be different. But that's just what it was. In a classy, if you've ever heard of the Munster Fest in Munster, Texas, like the German Fest, it was in one of those classy cups too. Yes, there we go. Let's go. It's a Munster Fest fan. Lots of good times there. So I'm drinking, you know, my Frenzy of box wine, and I get, you know, I can't remember. It's like one or two drinks in it. And thank God for the message of Alcoholics Anonymous. Thank God for that man taking time to 12-step me, because he interrupted my drinking. And for the first time ever, the things that guy said, even though I'm headed towards that path of destruction again, for some reason, what he said interrupted my thoughts for a minute. And I don't believe this to be true, but it was the thing that interrupted my drinking method. He said, Sean, you don't have to drink this way if you don't want to. Now, I know that I'm powerless over alcohol, so even if I don't want to drink, I'm still going to drink. But for whatever reason, that was the thing that interrupted my drinking that night. And I thought, okay, maybe I'll try this thing. Again, God did for me what I can't do for myself. And for the first time that I could ever recall, I walked over to that sink and I poured the drink down the drain. And I have not found it necessary to have a drink of alcohol since then. And I started going to meetings. And when you're 23 years old and you're going to college and you live in a bachelor pad where everybody likes to drink, you hide. What I did was I hid out in Alcoholics Anonymous. So I was the home group I went to had like 500 meetings a week. And so I was like there at the 6 o'clock, the 8 o'clock, the 10 o'clock. And then I would stay late. And I mean, it was so helpful for me. I don't think that's necessary for people to get sober, but it was helpful for me in the beginning because I was immersed in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I was afraid to go home because I was afraid if I went home, I'd start drinking again. And I was terrified. And at this point, I've got a week or a month. That's what our literature says. And my experience has been that I don't do well without a spiritual awakening at some point in there, or being introduced to something spiritual. Because at this point, I don't realize it, but I will learn very quickly that I have a spiritual malady, which just means that there's no amount of willpower that I have to actually get myself sober. And so I am completely defenseless against the first drink. I am completely powerless. And I'll convince myself to drink again every single time. And the only thing that can stop that is a power greater than me. And I choose to call God. And so I spend about 2 weeks just kind of going to 6 to 8 and 10 o'clock meetings. And about 2 weeks into that, I thought, if I don't get a sponsor, I'm gonna drink. Like, this whole meeting thing's not worth it for me. and I hope that you hear that. Like, if you just come to meetings, you're not working the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. The program of Alcoholics Anonymous, as I said before, and I will say it again, and I will continue to say it, because we sometimes forget, we are prone to forget that. The program of Alcoholics Anonymous is 12 steps of AA, as outlined in our first 164 pages. That's it. It's that simple. And when I do that with a sponsor, I have a pretty good experience. When I choose not to do that, and I choose to be dishonest, and I choose not to follow those directions, it doesn't go as well for me. And that's just been my experience. And it doesn't matter how many meetings I go to, I am sick enough to start believing the things that are running around in my head without some sort of accountability and some sort of spiritual awakening and some sort of principles to keep me on track. And that's what the 12 steps do. And so I found this sponsor. I asked him to sponsor me, and we got to work right away. The very first thing he did is the same thing that's recommended in the Working with Others. He said, hey, read the first 164 pages. And what he had me do was underline anything or highlight anything that I identified with. And then he said, I want you to circle all the musts. He said, because you hear a lot in these programs that this is suggested. He's like, but there's a lot of musts in this book. And he's like, that means that we must do this or we will drink again. And so I started doing that, read through it. And for whatever reason, again, willing, honest, and open-minded enough, I started doing it. And I was like on fire for this thing. And I'm thinking, okay, this is describing me. Yes, and it's making faith like kindergarten level simple. Great. And so I'm just falling in love with this literature. I'm finding myself in it. I can't get enough of it. I'm reading it just like the way that I drank. And I remember him early on saying that the men and women that he knew in this program that stayed and they enjoyed their sobriety, enjoyed their relationship with God, enjoyed the program, so much, they knew the literature and they knew where to find the solution and they knew where to find the answer. And it wasn't just something that they talked about. Like, no, they literally had it to memory to where they could recall it when they got in those spots where they needed to recall what our literature says. And so I just took that to heart. I was like, I'm going to memorize some of this stuff. Like, know where it says this and know where it says that. And that's, he modeled that for me. He very quickly was like, Sean, I'm going to ask you to do a few things. I want you to pray every morning and every night. And I thought, well, that's easy. And I like raised in the Baptist church. I'm good. Like, I know how to pray. And he's like, no, I want you to forget all of the ways that you used to pray before. And I just want you to pray the way that I'm going to tell you to pray. And then we'll talk about praying later on, but let's just do what I'm telling you to do. He said, Sean, I want you to ask God for a day of sobriety and I want you to hit your knees. And I thought, well, why can't I just walk around and talk to God? He's like, no. I want you to hit your knees, because if you hit your knees, it's very difficult for you to think you're better than anybody else. And right now you think you're better than nobody else. You may not know that, but right now you think you're better than everybody else. And I need you to understand that there's a power greater than you out there, and you're gonna bow to him, whether you like it or not. And I want you to say this prayer. And then at night, I want you to do the same thing. I want you to hit your knees. And I want you to thank God for day's sobriety. And so that started my journey into really what would begin to be step two. He said, Sean, there's going to be people in here that have less time than you. I want you to go introduce yourself to them. I want you to get their number. I want you to call them. I want you to tell them what you did in order to stay sober for 7, 10, 30 days, whatever it is. You haven't worked the steps. You're not going to sponsor anybody. Man, you can help a newcomer. So go introduce yourself. Hey, Sean, we take commitments at this meeting. And there may not be a sign-up sheet, but the men that I sponsor, I want them to be there 30 minutes early, and I want you to come and show up and make coffee. That was my first commitment in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I was so pissed off because I didn't drink coffee at the time. And I didn't want to be there. But I showed up. And what was amazing is I started to see some of the men and women who had long-term sobriety. They, too, got there early. And they hung around the coffee making area. And they started talking. And I started to listen to what they were saying for some reason. And I became less and less annoyed with what they were saying. More and more interested in how they got that. And it was amazing that this fellowship began to sprout up as a result of some of this direction. And he said, hey, Sean, I want you to call me every day. And I'll be honest with you, I was not great at that one. It took me about 30 days to figure out that I needed to call that man every day. Because I thought that it had to do with the fact that like something was on fire going on with me or something like that. And I was like, no, it's fine, man. Like I'm going to meetings. I'm reading the book. I'm doing the things. He's like, Sean, it's not about that. I want to know that you can make a commitment, and I want to know that you can keep a commitment. And so I'm asking you to call me every day, not because I'm real concerned about what we're going to talk about. We'll probably talk about some stuff, but I just want to know that you're going to do what you say you're going to do. Because now that we're in sobriety, we act like sober members of Alcoholics Anonymous. And you may not feel that way, and you may not like calling me, but I want you to call me every day. So I started trying to call him every day. And we started reading the literature, and he started pointing out things about the first step. And I began to be, it was about 30 days in, and I remember realizing for the first time that idea that I could drink like normal people someday was finally crushed. And that's what it says in the first page of chapter 3 of our book. And it was finally crushed that, okay, I'm not like everybody else, and I'm not going to be able to drink like anybody else ever again. And through a process of that prayer time, he began to teach me what it's like to come to believe in a power greater than myself that could restore me to sanity. It took me a second to figure out what insanity was and what he meant by that. And I'm just really a great guy that would give me rides to and from meetings that explained it to me one day that made it in a way that made sense. And he said, Sean, insanity is this. He said, 30 days ago, if I would have slid a drink your way, you would have convinced yourself that you could take that drink and do it normally. Or you wouldn't care and you just would have drank it anyways. That's insane in light of your history. And he said, but today, in active recovery, he said, you slide a drink your way. And as God begins to work in your life, as you begin to work these steps, you're going to slide that drink in your way. And you're going to look at that drink and you're going to know exactly what it'll do to you. And you won't drink it. That's being restored to sanity. And I thought, man, I want that. And I remember him taking me to the 10-step promises, and I don't have time to flip to it because I want to get sober and stay drunk way too long. There's so many good things that I want to talk about. I don't know why I stayed drunk so long. So I'm going to speed through this. But he began to helped me understand how to have faith in God. So the first thing he did, he said, "Hey, I want you to write out your idea of God. What's your concept of God?" And so I wrote it out, and with my history, I thought, dude, if I read this to this guy, like, he's going to be saved. He's going to come to faith. He's going to, like, come to faith in Jesus Christ, and it's going to be amazing. I'm back to witnessing. I've been sober 60 days. Why not? And man, that guy, we share the same God, and he was so kind to me. And I showed up to read that thing to him, and he just said, "Sean, do you believe that what's on that piece of paper can keep you sober one day at a time? Or at least, are you willing to believe in it?" And I said, "Yes, sir, I am." And he said, "Well, that's good enough for me." And I'm thinking, "You don't want me to read this to you?" He's like, "No." He said, "Because I believe that our literature is true, that however small your concept of God is, that if you'll start taking these actions, that concept of God will begin to grow bigger and bigger and bigger. And you'll really, truly come to believe in the God that you wrote about. And he'll probably be even bigger than what you put on that piece of paper, even as great as you think it is. It'll probably be better." And he was right. He was right. I wrote a small God on that piece of paper. Even though I thought it was incredibly theologically sound at the time. But man, I would have sold myself short, not understanding the true character of God. And because still some of those old ideas were there, that he was out there and he didn't really want a personal relationship with me, but he was just kind of out there. He was, man, again, if I followed the rules, then he would love me. So then he had me start memorizing the third step prayer. And I can remember, there is a story, and forgive me, I'm not, this story came to mind this today as I was thinking about this talk. But there's a story in the Bible that talks about it, Jesus tells, and he says that there's this lost sheep that goes away, and wouldn't any of you leave the 99 to go find the one? And I remember thinking, like, if I read that story back then, I would have thought, I can't be the one that he's going to go get. Like, I'm too far gone. I'm too far gone for him to go get me. But the way he tells that story is he says, wouldn't any of you go and put that sheep on your back and carry it back to the others? And I started thinking about my experience with step three. And even though I was kicking and screaming and trying to figure out, like, does this God really love me and all of these things, I remember for the first time on my knees saying the third step prayer. And it was as if the floodgates of grace just opened up in my life. And I began to realize that God doesn't want anything from me. He's not looking for me to be perfect. He's not looking for me to keep all the rules. He just loves me because he loves me, warts and all. Everything I'm bringing to the table, he loves me. And he came and he got me and he picked me up and he put me on his back. And he didn't do that because I'm special or anything like that. He just did it because he loves me. And I remember that being deeply profound to me, is that this creator that I believed in wanted a personal relationship with me. And Alcoholics Anonymous gave me that gift. And it says in there that we will be reborn. It is not just a simple decision. It says that we thought well before taking a step, making certain that we could at last abandon ourselves utterly to him. That means that I have to go from just believing in to fully trusting in. That is distinctly different. I believed in God for a long time, but fully trusting him and putting my faith in him was something totally different, and it was new. And then it says, next we launch, because now I have to figure out, how am I going to live by faith? And it says, next we launched, and we launched in this course of vigorous action, and we started to work the steps. And my experience with my first sponsor was that I had a hard time trusting him. And he shared with me that he may or may not talk about some of the things that I share with his wife. And that confused me at the time. I don't know why he told me that. I think God was doing something there. And anyways, I started backtracking, and I never got honest with him about my sex inventory. And so I was living one way in Alcoholics Anonymous and one way in my job, and then a totally different way outside of that. And I was still doing the same exact things to women that I was doing when I was drinking, but I was not drunk anymore. And that starts to eat at your conscience when you've been reborn, for me. And there was a series of circumstances that happened that led me to another rock bottom in sobriety. I was 9 months sober, and I realized that I had to get completely honest with another human being. That I was going to be the guy that was only going to be partially honest and never get completely honest until I told somebody all of my life story. And so I found a man that I was introduced to at a service commitment. I was taught to say yes in Alcoholics Anonymous when I'm asked if I don't have a prior commitment. and somebody asked me to come greet at the area assembly. I didn't know what the area assembly was. I didn't care about the business of Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't care about any of that stuff. I just went because he told me. And I was introduced to a man that would radically change my life. He would become my sponsor. He's been my sponsor now for the past 14 years. And that man started to give me some real direction. And I started to get honest with him. And I don't know why I chose to be honest with him outside of everybody else, but I chose to be completely honest with him. And I remember being on a ride to the Canyon Conference, and that was when I did my fifth step with him. And I remember taking that ride, and he's driving, and I'm talking, and he's relating, and he's listening a lot. And man, I told him some things that I thought I would never tell people. And they're not horribly embarrassing. Like, I've heard a lot of fist. It's all the same, man. Like, we're not special. And it's all the same character defects. Just they just manifest themselves differently. It's all the same. But he never said, oh my God, or like looked at me cross or anything like that. He just listened. And when we got there, I remember getting out of the car. He didn't say anything profoundly. He just was a close mouth, understanding friend. And I got to be completely honest with him. And for that brief moment, I got to taste what true humility felt like. Is that I did not care what another human being thought of me. And for whatever reason, God in that moment deflated my ego to where I'm like, I don't care what this dude thinks about me. I just got to get this all out. Now, after that hour, it quickly returned. But for that moment, I got to experience this freedom from self. And I thought, man, I want more of that. And I got out of that car and I felt lighter, and he gave me some directions about 6 and 7. And so I went and took those actions, and I sat quiet for an hour and asked God to remove those defects of character. And going back to that sheep analogy, it's interesting. If you have a sheep, and this made sense to me, especially in light of 6 and 7, is if you have a sheep and it gets cast because it has so much like weight from all the wool and stuff like that. If it gets cast, it means it gets like flipped upside down and it's on its back, and it can't get back up without a shepherd coming and helping it get back up. And then it'll keep casting until you actually shear it. And for me, and if you've ever seen a sheep get shorn before, if they don't trust the person doing it, they're crazy. But man, when they trust the shepherd, that shepherd can do whatever it wants because it trusts it. And I remember, for me, that's the way that step 6 and 7 has been, as my understanding, my relationship with God has grown bigger and bigger and has become more intimate. I trust him. And I trust him to remove my character defects. And I trust him to, if I fully surrender that to him, that he will remove them. He will shear it off. And I won't be so weighted down to where I'll flip over again on my back. No, and even if I do, the God of my understanding loves me enough to come down and pick me up and set me back up on my feet, shear me again, because I got there again. He's going to keep doing that on repeat. And 6 and 7 is where I spend a lot of my time now. Because the closer I draw to God, the more I realize it's wrong with me. Again, that God that I wrote on paper was so small. But the God of my understanding today is so big. And his character is so good. And if he's that way, and I'm the way that I am, the closer I get to him and the closer I draw to him, the more I'm going to realize how truly messed up I am. But the more I'm going to want to be like him. And that's been my experience in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I think that's what the steps have done for me. Started making some of those amends, and I'm going to try to be brief with this. And then I won't have time to talk about 10, 11, and 12, but I want to tell y'all kind of what it's like today. So my wife and I, Nicole and I, about a year after I got sober, I was put on a moratorium because of my relationship habits. And to put it just nicely, and he just said, hey, you can't date anybody until I tell you it's okay to date somebody. And I thought, that's excessive. All of my buddies that I was hanging out with were like on a year, and he called it a moratorium, which is a year. But then he gave me the direction of like, no, you're not going to date anybody until you say it's okay. And I'm thinking, is that like indefinitely, like forever? Is it like 5 years? Anyways, I did have the courage enough to ask him, and I said, hey, Nicole has come back into my life. I would really like to ask her out on a date. Would you be okay with that? Again, if you've not allowed a sponsor into your life in that way, I'm just telling you, you're not getting the full beauty of sponsorship. Like, if I only allow my sponsor to talk about my actions in Alcoholics Anonymous, I'm selling myself short. I've got to let that man know everything and let him give me direction, because I think God is speaking through that man. And it's been my experience for the past 14 years that his direction has really not ever failed me. Now, we've disagreed on some things, and we've come back to the drawing board and things like that over the years, but by and large, God has used that man to shape me. And anyway, so I let him in, and he said, "Yeah, you can ask her on a date, but you're going to do it on my terms." And I was like, "That seems loaded." And if any of y'all know, like, Language of the Heart and Naomi, he was heavily influenced by her when it had to do with dating. And so a lot of the direction I got, I didn't know at the time, was heavily influenced by Naomi. And she gave my sponsor a gift, and he gave it to me. And he said, "You're going to learn how to court this woman." He said, "Sean, you've never been friends with a woman your entire life, and you're going to have to learn how to be friends with her." And so he gave me some rules. I couldn't be alone with her because I couldn't be trusted. Every date we went on had to be public. I couldn't even walk her to her door like a gentleman because he was afraid I would go in. And like, it was just rigid. And I followed it. And then little by slowly, he started to loosen that up a little bit. And about our book says there's a long period of reconstruction ahead. And I know that some of you in the room are still on that long period of reconstruction ahead. And I don't know how it'll turn out for you. And I don't want you to hear this story and think, "Oh, it's going to turn out like that for me," because it may not. God may have a different plan for you. But for me, that long period of reconstruction led to me sitting in that woman's apartment alone, thinking about nothing more than, how can I repair this relationship? I wasn't thinking about getting something from her. I was thinking about, how can I help repair this relationship? And I had made an appointment to make an amends to her. I told her in a general way all the things that I had done wrong to her. I didn't mention names. It wasn't necessary. And I just told her all the things in a general way. And I said, "What can I do to make that right?" And she said, "You can just keep doing what you've been doing, so that somebody else doesn't have to go through what I went through." And so from that day until now, every time I tell my story, I tell that because I know that there's men and women in the room who maybe your actions were like mine. And maybe you didn't treat men or women very well. And maybe that hasn't changed in your experience, and you've stayed sober and you've kept doing the same thing over and over again. And I would just encourage you that there is a better way, and it's found in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And that started a beautiful relationship between her and I. And we got married about a year after that. We started having children, and it was awesome. And life was growing, and we had our first son, Lincoln. He's 7. Had Liam, 5, had Lennox in 2020. And man, I'm thinking, like, life is great. Alcoholics Anonymous has completely restored my life, my marriage. I look back, man, I got a second shot at this deal. And we, just because we get sober in Alcoholics Anonymous doesn't mean that we are not prone to experience tragedy. And on June 27th of 2021, my youngest son, Lennox, found his way into a pool, and he drowned. And we spent from June 27th of 2021 until July 3rd in a hospital, and got 6 sweet, sweet days with that baby. And when you're hit with something like that, you don't know what to do. For any of you that lost children, if for any of you that haven't, there's no pain like it. No pain like it. Nothing describes it. I can't even relate to other people because the pain is so different for every person, and it runs so deep. And so I'm sitting in that hospital room, and I'm watching my boy. I'm hopeless, and I don't know. At this point, it's not looking great. And so I began to pray, and I began to read to him, because I didn't know what else to do. And I just began to get back to the basics of what I learned in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I remember reading things to him, and I would pray, and I would read things to him, and I would pray. And for a while there, I thought, well, I'm reading this for him. I'm reading this for him to hear these things, and he's going to come back and all this other stuff. And I really believed that. But what I found was that I was reading things, and it was for me, because I was reading more and more about the God of my understanding, and I was being reminded of his character, even in tragedy. And I was being reminded of how good he is, even though things are terrible and bad and don't seem to be getting better. And on July 3rd of 2021, he passed away. And there were some hard decisions in that room that you just don't ever want to be faced with. And what I want to tell, the reason I tell you that story, and I got to shut up because I'm already 3 minutes over, and I apologize for that. But what I want to tell you about that is that I want to read this to you because this is what has rung in my head. I remember reading this really early on, and I remember thinking, I should probably hold on to that, and I should probably memorize that. And it's at the end of Bill's story, at the bottom of page 14. He says, "My friend had emphasized the absolute necessity of demonstrating these principles in all of my affairs. Particularly was it imperative to work with others as he'd worked with me. He said, faith without works was dead, he said. And how appallingly true for the alcoholic, for if an alcoholic failed to perfect and enlarge his spiritual life, how? Through work and self-sacrifice for others. He could not survive the certain, not the might be trials, the certain trials and low spots that lay ahead. If he did not work, the alcoholic did not work, he would surely drink again. And if he drank again, he would surely die. Then faith would be dead indeed. With us, it was just like that. And I want to tell you that as a result of God working through the program Alcoholics Anonymous, not one time have I thought about drinking alcohol. I have recovered from alcoholism. And I look at that radically different. And it is as if I recoil from it as from a hot flame, just like it's promised. I've been placed in a sense of neutrality. And I want to tell each of you that those promises are just as freely yours as they were mine. It will take work. The directions are simple, but man, the promises are so beautiful and profound. And you will be introduced, if you're experiencing them, I mean, you will be introduced into a God of your understanding that is so beautiful and so amazing. And even in light of what's happened to us, I know that God is good. And I know that he loves me. And just this past week, it's 2 years since he passed away. And just this last week, our experience through that, we were able to pass that along to another family whose child was involved in an ATV accident. He was killed. And I could take my experience and pass that along to this family to give them some semblance of hope. That's what this whole deal is about. Is I get to take the comfort that God has given me in my tragedy and pass that along to the next person. And what, you know what? He uses that every single time. So thanks a lot for sharing.